This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Wonders of the World, Trials of the Soul, and Revelations of the Spirit. This is Lecture 2. I have attempted to put before you the ideas of the people of ancient Greece regarding the connection between the human soul and the evolution of the earth. In doing so, I specially emphasized two points of view, stating that the Greeks were fully aware that in ancient times the human soul was endowed with clairvoyant capacities, and that Persephone, the daughter of Demeter, was regarded by them as the regent of those forces which work upon the human soul from the cosmos. On the other hand, I said that everything that might be called the intellectual culture of humanity found expression in that stream of thought with which the names of Odysseus, Menelaus, and Agamemnon are associated, and the feeling was evoked that, for this form of culture, a continual sacrifice was necessary, so that the best feelings and perceptions of which the human soul was capable, when under the influence of intellectual culture, were, so to speak, sacrificed to a certain religious sacerdotalism. This thought is represented in the sacrifice of Iphigenia. From such views as these, we are able to perceive that in ancient Greece the tradition, and to some extent the direct knowledge of what we are now striving to attain in our spiritual science, were fully active. We pointed out that in those days of antiquity, the human soul possessed clairvoyant vision. You may read in Esoteric Science how, in the days of Atlantis, human souls looked into the spiritual worlds, and how cosmic forces actually appeared to them as forms. So that people did not speak at that time of mere abstract forces, since those forces were living forms. A consciousness of such living forms has been preserved to us in the figure of Persephone. Slowly we strive through spiritual science to recognize once more, from a new point of view, the same living forms in the spiritual world which were so well known to mankind in the days of antiquity, and which in the mythology of the ancient Greeks were hidden within the forms of their gods. The more profoundly we give ourselves up to a study such as that of Greek mythology, the greater will be our reverence for and our wonder at the vast cosmic wisdom concealed in it. To give you an idea of the depth of wisdom contained in the whole of this teaching about the gods, may I call your attention to one particular. I said yesterday that Greek mythology points to two streams of culture, the one intellectual, with which Menelaus, Agamemnon, and Odysseus are coupled, and which is so beautifully represented in the sacrifice of Iphigenia, the other connected with Persephone and her mother Demeter. Everyone who thinks about the world must necessarily reflect that currents such as these cannot be independent of one another. Though they appear to us to be separate, they must nevertheless have an inner connection, some point of contact. How does Greek mythology express the deep wisdom underlying the connection between the Demeter and the Agamemnon currents? We know that modern science has nothing to give us in this connection but a few abstract ideas. The history of the Greek gods and heroes, however, tells us things such as this. It carries the ancestry of Agamemnon back to a representative of the forces of the human soul, whom we may call Tantalos. From the Greek legend we know that Tantalos wantonly offered his own son to the gods as food, and the gods noted the impious nature of this act. But one of the goddesses partook of a shoulder blade, and she was Demeter. By this strange symbolism, the partaking of the shoulder blade of the son of Tantalos by Demeter, a hint is given of these two streams of culture. There is a connection between them. Demeter-like forces enter into all modern intellectual culture, which is connected with the names of Agamemnon, Menelaus, and Odysseus. For every characteristic of Greek mythology, we rediscover an equivalent in modern spiritual wisdom, and it is not superfluous to call attention from time to time to such profound and significant traits. For they enable us to recognize how the manner in which the human being contemplates the external wonders of nature changes in the course of time. Modern natural science is proud of its interpretation of nature. But it has little reason for pride when we consider that the Greeks, in the forms which they gave to their gods, expressed the profound force of nature as the regent of nature's wonders. They betrayed a far deeper natural wisdom than is dreamt of in any science of our day, a wisdom that will never be dreamt of till spiritual science has been given a place in our civilization. These are suggestive points of interest, stimulating us to extend the knowledge we have acquired in the course of years and compare it with the profound truths contained in Greek mythology. One event in the Mystery of Eleusis points to a wonder of nature, great in its significance. What is the fact of fundamental importance in the Mystery of Eleusis? The fact that Persephone, the representative of the ancient clairvoyant forces of the human soul, is carried off by Hades, the god of the netherworld. The whole of this remarkable action must be vitally present to you as seen in this new creation of the Eleusinian mystery in the being representing Hades or Pluto. What do we find when we apply what is expressed in Greek mythology and in the Mystery of Eleusis to the nature of man himself? What has become of the old clairvoyant capacity of the human soul, referred to in our spiritual science? We might truly say, the rape of Persephone has been in progress since most early times, and down to our own day. The old clairvoyant culture has vanished. In truth, however, nothing in the world is lost. Things only change. What has become of Persephone? What is her work today, the work of the regent of the old clairvoyant forces in human nature? There is a state of consciousness active within us which might be called a wider, more all-embracing, subconscious soul life, which does not, however, rise into consciousness in the majority of human beings at the present day. It is better to call it a subconsciousness than an unconscious soul life. In that subconscious life of our soul, in that which is at work within us today, without our knowledge or intellectual understanding, we find Persephone. Thither the ancient clairvoyant forces have fled. In the most remote times, these forces operated in the human soul, so as to enable it to behold the spiritual worlds with clairvoyant vision. In our day, they are active in the depths of the soul. They assist in the development and formation of the ego principle, making it continually stronger and more self-reliant. Thus these forces, that in olden times were dedicated to the bestowal of the powers of clairvoyance on humanity, have now the task of strengthening and consolidating our ego principle. The Persephone forces have really retreated into the nether world of the human soul. They are taken captive by that which slumbers in the depths of the human soul, and in one sense are held in bondage by those hidden depths. In the progressive course of human evolution, the rape of Persephone has been accomplished by those forces of the soul which are situated deeply within it, and which are represented outwardly in nature by Hades or Pluto. According to Greek mythology, Hades reigns in the subterranean realms of earth. But the Greek knew that the same forces which are active in the depths of the earth are also active in the depths of the human soul. As Persephone was carried off by Hades, so the ancient faculty of clairvoyance was captured by the gods of the netherworld within the individual soul. Persephone is the daughter of Demeter, and we are thus led to the opinion that we may look upon Demeter as a still older regent, both of the external forces of nature and of the forces of the human soul. I have already shown that Demeter is a figure in Greek mythology, which points us to a period of ancient Atlantean clairvoyance, a period to which the most ancient treasures of Atlantean wisdom belong. and it is here that Demeter is really to be found. When the Atlantean gazed into the spiritual world, he saw Demeter. He actually encountered her. Now, what were the reflections of the Atlantean when this primal mother of the human soul and of the fruitful forces of nature appeared to him out of the whirling substances of the spiritual worlds, which were ever in motion, ever assuming new forms? He said to himself, not consciously, but as it were unconsciously, quote, "I have accomplished nothing. I have gone through no inner development, as will be necessary in later times, to enable me to behold the spiritual world. The same natural forces which gave me my eyes, my brain, my organism, and which work in me, also give me the force of clairvoyance. I am clairvoyant in the same way I breathe." Close quote. Just as no special development was required to produce respiration in man, so neither did he bring forth the powers of clairvoyance in himself. They were given him by nature's forces, by divine beings. And when he let his gaze wander over the outer world, over all that was within the limits of his existence, and perceived spiritual things together with things of sense, he was conscious that he was absorbing into himself the substances of the vegetable kingdom of the surrounding world, which was then different from what it is now. When he was taking into himself all that grew in the world outside, he was simultaneously absorbing the forces that were active there. The man of those times was by no means so narrow-minded as to believe that the nourishment which he absorbed was composed merely of physical substances which could be chemically examined. He knew that he imbibed the inner configuration of the forces active in all these substances, and that these forces contained that of which he was composed and of which his body was built up. He said to himself, quote, "In nature, forces are at work. They enter into me with my food and with my breath. In their external activity, they are governed by the great Demeter." Close quote. He felt it was the great Demeter who sent her forces into the human soul. There, in the process of digestion, they underwent a change, to put it crudely, which was a spiritual process, which transformed them into clairvoyant capacities. Through the forces active in Demeter, as fruitful goddess in the world of nature, there is born in man, in his human organism, the gift of clairvoyance, represented by Persephone. Thus man feels that he has his place among the wonders of nature. He feels the faculty of seership born within him as the birth of Persephone. He feels that he has to thank Demeter for this birth, Demeter, who causes the same forces to evolve everywhere in the universe around, as then evolved in the power of clairvoyance. In this way the men of old looked up to Demeter, and in ancient Greece a memory remained of the devotion paid to that great goddess. We have already seen that the human organism, the outer organization of the body, has changed since those ancient times. Our body, with its present organization of muscles and bones, is considerably denser and more solid than that of the human beings who gave birth to Persephone, and who still possessed the old faculty of clairvoyance. Because it has become denser, our body can, so to say, hold captive the clairvoyant forces in the nether world of the soul. The imprisonment of the clairvoyant forces within the human soul is due to the densification of the human body. It was still felt in ancient Greece that as the old, more pliable human body grew denser, it absorbed the forces active in the interior of the earth. Whereas, formerly, it was governed more by the forces inherent in the air, which kept it in an ethereal state. Stronger and ever stronger became the influence of the forces in the interior of the earth upon the human physical body, the forces governed by Hades. So that we may say that Hades became ever more active within the human being. He densified the human body, and in doing so, captured Persephone. This densification extended even to the physical body, for even in the earliest post-Atlantean periods, the human organism wore a very different aspect from that of today. It is very short-sighted to think that the form of man has always been as it is now. Thus, beneath the nature wonders of man's own being, we can perceive the rape of Persephone and the relationship of man to Demeter. We also find, prevailing in Greek mythology, the consciousness that man is a microcosm, an expression of the macrocosm or great universe. As Demeter works outside in the mighty forces of all that grows and bears fruit on the earth, so the offspring of Demeter works within. As the forces, represented by Hades, work not on the surface of the earth, but within it, so Hades works within the individual human organism. We must be able to turn away completely from all that is customary at the present day, from the habits and usages of our present lives, to understand the totally different mode of thought of the Greeks. Modern man looks to government or to parliament. These institutions give him his laws, and he would regard the idea as folly that cosmic forces pass through the heads of those who sit in parliament, or that divine forces reign there. We need not follow up this question. It would sound absurd to the modern man, but it was not so in the times which preceded written history, any more than it was in the days of ancient Greece. In those past ages, an idea prevailed at once so strange and magnificent that it is scarcely comprehensible to the man of today. Think of all that I have said about the development of the Greek gods, how I indicated the way in which Demeter worked in ancient times, how she directed to human nature the forces working in the vegetable kingdom, and caused her child to be born in human nature. It was thus she worked in olden times. Other gods worked in like fashion in those days. They also worked with the forces and the wonders of nature. How was it they worked? When man ate and breathed, he knew that it was the great Demeter who filled the air and the plants with the forces which he imbibed into himself. It was Demeter who gave him his clairvoyant consciousness. It was she who directed him how to steer his course in the world. There were no laws at that time in the modern sense, no outwardly expressed commandments. But, as man was clairvoyant, it dawned on him clairvoyantly what he should do, and what was right and good. In those remote times he saw in Demeter the being from whom he derived his nourishment, and also the universal force, the force of nature, which, while he absorbed nutritive substances, transformed them in him, so that they gave him his morals, his rules of conduct. He thought as follows, quote, "I raise my eyes to the great Demeter, and whatever is accomplished by me in the world is done because the forces, which are without in the plant world, are directed into my brain." Close quote. She, the Demeter of olden times, was an unquestioned lawgiver, not illuminating the consciousness, but stimulating the soul to action. This was also the case with other gods. By nourishing the human being, by enabling man to breathe, by inspiring him with the impulse to stand upright and to walk, they gave him at the same time the impulse to morality and to all outward conduct. Because the gods assumed those human forms already referred to, we say that Demeter saw in the loss of her child Persephone a loss in the depths of human nature. This was the rape by the denser corporeality of the clairvoyant forces, so that they were henceforward directed merely to the gross nourishment of the body. When Demeter withdrew, as it were, from directly imparting the moral law in ancient times, what followed? She instituted a mystery, and by so doing provided, from that time on, a new law as a substitute for the old law which had worked through the forces of nature. Thus the gods withdrew from the forces of nature and entered within the mysteries, bestowing on man the precepts of morality, as he no longer had morals imparted to him directly through the workings of nature. The ancient Greek held the opinion that in olden times the gods had conferred on man moral precepts along with the forces of nature. These forces then gradually withdrew. As a compensation, the gods afterward gave the moral law in a more abstract form, through their messengers and the mysteries. Owing to this estrangement from nature, man needed a more abstract intellectual system of morality. For this reason, the old Greeks looked to the mysteries for guidance in their moral life, and in the mysteries they recognized the activities of the gods in their moral principles, as they had formerly recognized them in the forces of nature. Therefore, in the earliest times of Greek civilization, the moral laws were ascribed to those gods who had worked in primeval times through the forces of nature. In alluding to the origin of their most ancient laws, it was to no parliament that the Greek looked, but to the gods who had come down to men, and who in the mysteries gave them the laws which then continued as human morality. But what became of that primal force of Demeter herself, when the human body grew denser and changed? To make use of a somewhat homely simile, you all know that we cannot do quite the same thing with ice as with water, though the ice is water in another form. Neither was it possible to accomplish with the denser human body what had been possible formerly by means of the force of nature, with the finer body. By instilling into the latter the spiritual forces which come from the products of nature, Demeter brought about the development of clairvoyant powers in man. What happened to the forces of Demeter in consequence of the densification of the human body, or, in the words of Greek mythology, what happened through the rape of Persephone by Hades? The Demeter forces had to withdraw from the organism of the human body. They had to become less effectual. It was necessary that man should be removed from the immediate influence of Demeter, and so he was subjected to the other forces to which I alluded yesterday. What makes the dense human body vigorous and healthy? As in ancient times, Demeter made the ancient human body vigorous and healthy, so it is Eros, or the element represented by Eros in the forces of nature, who makes the new body young and vigorous. If Eros did not work upon it, and had Demeter continued to do so, the human body would have been withered and wrinkled all through life. The forces of Demeter are not found in the fresh bodies and chubby and rosy cheeks of our day, but they are found when the Eros forces have been eradicated from the body. This happens when the body grows old and becomes dry and wrinkled. We find this deep truth in the mystery of Eleusis. After the rape of Persephone, Demeter appears denuded of her original forces. She is transformed by Hecate, and in such a way that she now only displays the forces of decline. In fact, from the rape of Persephone onward, we can observe the withdrawal of Demeter from the purely human bodily organism, a circumstance which may also be observed in the history of human evolution. Oh, these wonders of nature, so splendidly expressed in the antique figures of the gods! When, with advancing years, Eros retires from the human being, the influence of Demeter on the human bodily organization begins again. In a certain way, Demeter can then re-enter the human bodily organism. The forces representative of fruitful chastity take the foremost place, while the Eros forces fall into the background. When we consider the aging of the human being, in conjunction with the transformation of the forces of Eros into those of Demeter, we touch upon a deep and mighty mystery in man's evolution. Profound truths such as these were veiled within the Eleusinian drama. So profound is that drama that the cultured man of our day would most certainly regard what I have just said as fantastic speculation. What has just been said, however, is no fantasy. It is the assertion of materialistic learning upon these matters that is the veriest superstition, the real fantasy. What then has really changed in human nature in the course of ages, since the days of old Atlantis till the present time? It is the sheaths in which the real human being is enveloped that have changed. The human being is wrapped in his three sheaths, the physical, the etheric, and astral bodies, so that our innermost self is implanted within these three coverings. These sheaths have undergone a transformation in the course of evolution, from Atlantean times up to the present. And we ask now, what has actually been the impelling factor needed to produce the change in these sheaths? We must seek that driving, impelling factor which has brought about the change, in the first place, in the human etheric body. That body is the factor of strength, the actual working force. It has densified the physical body and changed the astral body. For these three bodies are not so ordered that they are like the rinds of fruit or the layers of an onion, one outside the other. Their forces mutually interpenetrate, and there is a living interchange between them. The most important and active of the sheaths in this work of transformation, which is the historical evolution of man, is the etheric body. Let us represent the three bodies of the human being symbolically in a diagram. And there's apparently one on page 29 of this book. I shall simply draw the three bodies, physical, etheric, and astral, in three divisions, one above the other. The forces actually effectual here, especially the forces of Eros and Demeter, we must seek in this etheric body. From the etheric body they are directed upward into the astral and downward into the physical, so that the etheric body influences both the astral and the physical body. The work of the etheric on the physical body at that time was, in the first place, to render it denser and more solid, while its influence on the astral body was such that the latter no longer developed clairvoyance, but in its place the human intellectual forces. This work of transformation of the human being, in consequence of the work of the etheric body on all the three sheaths, produced in the course of time the most important and essential alterations in the three bodies themselves. They all became completely metamorphosed. An Atlantean body, and even a post-Atlantean body of the earliest period, was different from one of our day. All the circumstances and conditions of life were different then. All the conditions were changed. In the first place, if we consider the physical body in its vital development, from the earliest times down to the present, we find that owing to its densification, that body has been more subjected to the external influences of its physical environment. In ancient times, the plastic physical body was influenced more by the spiritual conditions of existence, while in modern times, on account of its density, it has become subject to the external conditions of the physical plane. Owing to this circumstance, certain peculiarities of the physical body, which in earlier times did not exist in the same form, have been intensified. The phenomena of disease of the physical body especially have changed. What we call the sickness or health of the physical body was governed by very different causes in ancient times. Then everything relating to the health of the human being was in direct connection with the conditions of the spiritual world. At the present day, man's physical body is inseparable from outer physical circumstances and conditions, and is, therefore, dependent on these. The conditions on which health depends must be sought today directly in the external physical conditions of life. In the words of Greek mythology, in consequence of the rape of Persephone by Hades and her captivity in the netherworld of human nature, the most inward, essential part of man's being has been subjected to outer circumstances in respect to the conditions of illness and health. This is one of the changes which the human organism has undergone. The second change relates to the human etheric body itself. It is true that the forces of metamorphosis are in that body, but it has itself changed as well. In earliest days, the etheric body was so organized that the human being did not become acquainted with the world as man does today. When man looked into the spiritual world by the old Persephone clairvoyance, he saw images there of spiritual beings. He was then surrounded by a world of pictures. It is true that these pictures were called up by the forces of the astral body, but if the astral body depended upon its own forces alone, it could not perceive those pictures. The astral body sees no pictures when it is thrown upon its own resources. Just as a man does not see himself advancing unless confronted by a mirror, so the astral body could not perceive the pictures created by itself if its activity were not reflected in man's being by the mirror of the etheric body. The etheric body makes visible the pictures called up by the astral body. What the man perceives of all that takes place in his own astral body is what is reflected by his etheric body. If all the inner processes of our astral bodies were not mirrored by the etheric body, we should indeed still have within us all that the astral body accomplishes, but we could not behold it, and would be unaware of it. Therefore, the entire presentation of the universe man forms for himself, the whole content of his consciousness, is reflected from his etheric body. It depends altogether on the etheric body whether he knows or does not know anything of the world. In the old days of clairvoyance it was thus, and it is still the case today, that all knowledge of the world depends upon the mirroring of the astral activities in the human etheric body. What underlies the forces of the etheric body? Underlying the forces of this etheric body is the fact that in them we have the key to our knowledge of the world. Otherwise, all that is effected in our astral bodies by the world would be powerless to open to us the gates of knowledge. The key to knowledge of the world lies in the etheric body, and it contains, besides all that enables us to speak as we do regarding several important passages in the two first Rosicrucian dramas. Let me read that part again. And it contains, besides all that enables us to speak as we do regarding several important passages in the two first Rosicrucian dramas. In these, mention is made of the labyrinth of thought, and of the threads which our knowledge must spin. We do not learn to understand the world by merely gazing at it. We learn to understand the world either by passing from picture to picture, as in the old clairvoyant state, or as in our modern intellectual culture, from idea to idea, through the labyrinth of thought spoken of above. This association of ideas is also caused by the forces of the etheric body. Therefore, what we may call the key of knowledge, the threads connecting the various images in our consciousness by which we attain to understanding, have been changed. Thus we see how much depends upon the forces of the etheric body and how they must have altered. Let us now consider the third member, the astral body itself. The astral body is the element in which the influences of the world are active in us, and in which the powers and capacities are molded, which are then mirrored by the etheric body. Knowledge is kindled in the astral body. It is brought to the consciousness by the etheric body. A thought or an image is kindled in the astral body. It is in us because we have an astral body. But we are conscious of the image or thought because we have an etheric body. It would still be in us even had we no etheric body, but we should be unconscious of it. The torch of knowledge is kindled in the astral body. It is mirrored, as the conscious knowledge of the individual, in the human etheric body, so that we may say, in the human astral body the torch of knowledge is kindled, and this torch changes in the historical progress of human evolution. In ancient times, man's consciousness was a clairvoyant picture consciousness, while at the present day it is an intellectual or reasoning consciousness. Thus the forces of the astral body have changed. While man was thus going through his historical evolution, there were forces at work within human nature which brought about an alteration in his entire relationship to Demeter. out of the rarefied body of ancient times, out of the astral body with its ancient clairvoyant capacities, Demeter was, so to say, driven out. Eros entered. Other human forces, different in character and independent of Eros, came more under the influence of Demeter. Therefore, in the period between Atlantean times and the present day, an evolutionary force worked in three different ways upon the nature of man, a threefold kind of growth, of transformation, and of metamorphosis. Starting from the etheric and passing on to the physical body, then to the etheric body itself, and then to the astral body, this force of growth and of change was active in human nature and is in us now. It changes us from youth to ripe age by transforming the forces of Eros into those of Demeter. This threefold development is a part of our organization. It brings about other conditions, those of sickness and health in our physical body. It causes that different mirroring of knowledge in the etheric body, and it transforms the torch of knowledge in the astral body. How marvelous it is that the figure representing these evolutionary forces of human nature should greet us from ancient Greek mythology, forces working in all of us and transforming our astral body, and therefore also the nature of Demeter. These forces within the human etheric body, which work upon the physical body, on itself, and on the astral body, are represented by the threefold Hecate. What we now mean when we say forces issue from the etheric body, which have a threefold power of transformation, was expressed by the Greek in his allusions to the threefold Hecate. A nature miracle of the human organism and its development is expressed in this image of the threefold Hecate. An immense vista of wisdom is here unveiled to us. Her statue may still be seen in Rome at the present day. Hecate is there, represented in her threefold aspect as follows. The first aspect, which relates to the conditions of sickness and health, shows the symbol of the dagger and the serpent, which latter is also given to Asclepios as representative of the science of health. The dagger typifies external influences of destruction affecting the human organism. By depicting Hecate in one of her aspects, with the dagger and the serpent, a hint was given that those forces were meant which influence the etheric body in respect of its growth and development. The second aspect of Hecate had, necessarily, to indicate that in the etheric body, the key to the understanding of the world had changed. What is the symbol of the second aspect of the threefold Hecate? The key and a coil of rope, typifying the labyrinth of thought. In her third aspect, Hecate bears a torch, representing the torch of knowledge, as developed in the astral body. We can now feel how stupendous is the weight of materialistic superstition with which men nowadays regard this profoundly significant figure of a past age, and how new life will be instilled into such things when men have learned anew what is actually meant by the profound symbolism of the three aspects of Hecate. The thought of ancient Greece will rise anew when human souls, steeped in spiritual science, contemplate works of art in this way. In such souls, all the wisdom of the spiritual nature of man that has been mysteriously hidden in such figures will well up anew. These things must not be interpreted in an abstract sense. We can, of course, only express them by clothing them, as it were, in abstract form. But all this may become for us a living feeling if we are filled with the consciousness that Hecate has but changed the manner of her working, and that she is still within us today, that she is active in each one of us. It was said by the ancient Greek that not only all human development, but every human being is subject to the forces of Hecate during the transformation of his bodily form and the mutations of his physical, etheric, and astral bodies. Hecate works in every individual in a threefold manner. The lessons imparted to the human soul in those times by the statue of Hecate may be given also today. How does the modern follower of spiritual science, who now no longer expresses himself in a figurative manner, impart his instructions? He tells us that in the course of human evolution, from the time of birth of the individual to the age of maturity, the three principles of the human body are metamorphosed. In the first 7 years, the physical, in the second 7, the etheric, and in the third 7, the astral body. The forces which are described without the figure of speech used here in my little book, The Education of Children, the forces active in triple form in the human organization, are the forces of Hecate. In the teaching of modern spiritual science, that the upbuilding of his physical body is carried on by man up to the second dentition, an indication is given of one aspect of Hecate working in him. Here in modern language is expressed what the Greek intended to show when he represented one aspect of Hecate with dagger and serpent. The second period of change in man is represented by the key and the coil of rope. Here is expressed the activity of the etheric body working from within on itself in the second 7 years. The third period of 7 years, wherein changes occur in the astral body, is imaged by the symbol of the torch. Thus, in its essentials, I gave long ago in modern book form what the wisdom of Hecate meant to the old Greeks, and what was expressed by the image of Hecate in the ancient Greek mysteries. In this is also to be found the significance of the development of our European civilization. Let us look back to the days of ancient Greece. Here, in the traditions of Greek mystic lore and of Greek mythology, we find the mighty images which were placed before those seeking instruction to awaken in their souls the knowledge necessary for man in those days. The image of the threefold Hecate did not awaken knowledge in the form in which it is absorbed by us at the present day. When we consider this teaching of the threefold change that occurs from the time of birth till about the 20th year. In pondering over such teachings, we faithfully tread the path which human civilization must follow. The old clairvoyant form of knowledge had to sink down into the kingdom of Hades, within the human soul, and for a while, from the time of Socrates till our own day, it was necessary that ignorance should, to a large extent, prevail with regard to all these matters. The task before man was to consolidate his capital I principle and to develop his egoity. The ancient wisdom of the Greeks, stimulated by those grandiose images, remained below the surface of the human soul. There it lay as if buried under the dust of intellectual culture. Now it reappears once more from the depths of spiritual darkness. In anthroposophy or spiritual science, there emerges from modern life that which had sunk into the depths of the human soul. We now begin again, in the manner described by me in the title Education of Children, to recognize the threefold Hecate in a more abstract form. By this means, the human soul, notwithstanding the prevailing intellectuality, is prepared for a new clairvoyance of the future, and the preparation for this future clairvoyance is our spiritual science. Oh, that threefold Hecate, of whom the Greeks spoke, Demeter, Persephone, and all the other figures, which in those days were not the abstractions that superstitious wiseacres of our day imagine, but living forms of Greek seership. All these forms will reappear to clairvoyant vision, and will descend more and more on man from the spiritual worlds in the future. The force which finds its way into human souls in order to give rise again to these clairvoyant powers, is the same force which, as conscious thought, was first prepared for man's understanding in the ancient cult of Jehovah. This force attained full development with the coming of Christ, which fact will be recognized more and more by the human race. And when, within the circle of true spiritual science, it is said that in this 20th century clairvoyant vision will already begin to reappear, and that human beings will already be found who can behold the Christ clairvoyantly, who, since the mystery of Golgotha, has been united with the earth? It is always added at the same time that the second coming of Christ will, as a matter of course, not be in a physical body, but will be visible to etheric vision, as in the case of Paul before Damascus. Through the Christ force, all the necessary impulses are given to human nature, by which this is restored, and by which man is enabled to behold all that has disappeared into the subconscious depths of the soul, as, for instance, the figures of Greek mythology. This will be the greatest event in the future evolution of the human soul, an event for which spiritual science must make preparation, so that human souls may be made capable of acquiring this etheric vision. In the next 3,000 years, an ever-increasing number of human souls will be filled with this impulse, and that lapse of time will be mainly devoted to kindling forces within the human soul, which will make it aware of the etheric wonders of surrounding nature. In the present century, isolated individuals will begin to see with their etheric soul the reappearing Christ. The numbers of these will increase more and more the next 3,000 years. Then the true Oriental tradition will be fulfilled, which agrees with all genuine occultism, namely that at the end of these 3,000 years, the Maitreya Buddha, descending to mankind, will speak in an equally comprehensible way to the human soul, and will then impart the Christ nature to man. This is the secret guarded by Oriental mystic wisdom, that in about 3,000 years the Maitreya Buddha will appear. What Western civilization has to contribute is the teaching that the cosmic individuality has appeared once and only once in a physical body, and that he will become ever more visible to etheric vision as time goes on. You will find this truth emphasized in the mystery drama, The Soul's Probation, and with it something is confided to the human soul. With words compelling as these, spoken by Buddha 2,000 years ago, regarding what at that time seemed natural to the most advanced souls of his day, the Maitreya Buddha will then proclaim everywhere what at present it is impossible to speak of publicly, but which will come to pass through the etheric vision of the Christ. This is the greatest event of the 20th century, this upward development of human nature to that which may be called a repetition of the vision of St. Paul. At that time this could occur to one person only, to Paul in his vision of Damascus. In future, beginning with the present century, it will be possible by degrees for the whole of mankind. That man who has faith in the progress of human nature, and who believes that the human soul will develop ever higher and higher forces, knows that it was necessary for the human soul, which had sunk to the profoundest depths of the physical plane, that Christ should appear once in a physical body. It was necessary, because at that time the human soul could only see the divinity in a body visible to physical sight. Inasmuch as this event took place, inasmuch as this event had been prepared by the ancient cult of Jehovah and then actually came to pass, the human soul has been guided to ever higher and higher powers. The enhancement of these capacities is shown in that men will now learn to see Christ, even when he is no longer with us in physical form, in the form in which he has been with us since the mystery of Golgotha, a form visible, of course, only to clairvoyant sight. Christ is present here. He is united with the etheric body of the earth. The most essential thing is that the human soul should strive to develop so as to be able to see him. Herein lies the great advance in the evolution of the human soul. And whoever believes in the progress of that soul, whoever believes that spiritual science has a purpose and a mission to fulfill concerning this progress, will understand that the forces of the human soul must increase ever more and more, and that it would signify stagnation of its forces if the human soul of our own time were obliged to see Christ in the same physical form in which it once beheld him. Anyone who believes in progress and in the purpose and mission of spiritual science, knows that there is a sublime meaning in the old Rosicrucian formula regarding the being who was the Son of God, and who incarnated once in a physical body. He knows that from the present century onward, according to prophecy and to our own knowledge, that being will become increasingly visible to human souls in an etheric vision. He who believes in the advance of human development believes also in the return of the Christ, who will be visible to those gifted with etheric sight. Let him who does not believe in progress hold to the opinion that the powers of the human soul remain stationary. Such a one demands the reappearance of Christ in our day, in the same form in which he appeared before, when humanity had descended to the lowest depths of materialism. He believes in the return of Christ in a physical body. The end of Lecture 2.